Session number 10203, reel 2.
Mr. Nunley, reel 2.
The company commander and the other officers marched onto the parade ground and represented the fourth side of the square. The company commander assented to the carrying out of the punishment and selected Ascari, then delivered the punishment. It was a scene which impressed itself indelibly on my memory, and I was very glad indeed when, not so very long after, that punishment was abolished, except in certain even more grave the circumstances. I can only say in my defence, in a way, that I was very young, I was very inexperienced, I had not realised that that type of punishment existed until I witnessed it, and I have asked myself in the years that have followed many, many times, would I, had I known what the punishment was to be, have placed that sentry under close arrest? Well, you asked me what sort of disciplinary problems there were. Sentries falling asleep was one, failing of discipline. Others were trivialities, improperly dressed, being slovenly. Very little theft amongst the troops, in my experience, as between one soldier and another. Generally, I would say the discipline was very, very good indeed in my 4 years with the KAR. I can't think offhand of any other manifestation of lack of discipline, but I believe that the punishment for falling asleep when you are facing the enemy is quite inexcusable. And I did have a second experience of that in Burma itself.
We'll come on to that later. You mean the punishment was inexcusable, or
the falling asleep, the misdemeanour, quite inexcusable, as it placed at risk the lives of so many others.
How did the Ascari take his corporal punishment on that occasion?
Stoically.
Did he bear any resentment afterwards?
Certainly not that I'm aware of. It was often said that an Ascari preferred the instant and summary punishment to a fine from his pay. Now, whether that is what Europeans would like to believe or whether it is a fact, I can't really say.
Did they express any opinion about forms of punishment to you?
No. I think they accepted that there was a military code which they were learning as the length of their service increased, and they just took it that this was the way of the army.
Why was corporal punishment abolished, do you know?
No, I don't, but I suspect that it was, I like to believe that it was seen to be wrong to whip people as though this was a perpetuation of practices of the 19th century.
Do you know when it was abolished?
Well, I think it was only probably end of 1943, perhaps beginning of 1944.
Was that the only one you witnessed?
Oh, yes.
Now, can we take the story on a bit further? But before we do, actually, there's one thing I need to ask you about motivation, because you said that they joined to serve King George, but what do you think really motivated the Askari to fight and to risk his life?
I've often wondered this. There are, as I said, those who believe that the African was a mercenary, and therefore he would have been prepared in exchange for pay, rations and accommodation and uniform to have fought for anybody. I don't believe that. I believe myself that there was a patriotism which had developed since the late 19th century, as Kenya, Tanganyika and Uganda began to see European settlers. I want to believe that, because I can hardly credit that Africans would otherwise be prepared to put their lives at risk simply for 2 shillings a day. And the pay is not exactly munificent, and the rations were, the only merit of the rations, you might say, was that they were relatively balanced and they were regular.
But was there loyalty to Tanganyika or to their tribe or to the king or Britain or you personally as the officer?
I think it was to King George, this mystic figure who wore a crown. I don't believe it was to Tanganyika, because I can't recall any Askari ever really talking about the country. He'd talk about his tribe and his tribal customs, but whereas we would talk about being British and of Britain, they certainly didn't talk about Tanganyika as being the country of their birth, etc., etc., etc. I don't believe that it was loyalty to the officer. I think that was part and parcel of the whole business of being at war. Affection and a personal loyalty to the officer, just as much as he demonstrated his affection and personal loyalty to the troops. So I think the answer must be that they're all young men looking for adventure, and here was adventure coming along in the shape of serving this mystic King George in far-off England.
Did the King's African Rifles mean anything to them from the point of view of royalty?
I certainly think that did. I think that was instilled into them, as it would be instilled into any soldier joining any part of the British Army or the East African Forces or the Indian Army or any other military formation. After all, the King's African Rifles had got a fairly brief history. I suppose they were beginning to be formed in the 1890s. They had certainly fought as a regular formation in East Africa in World War I. They had been on police duties since their formation in the 1890s, when they were called the East Africa Rifles, by the way. Police duties in the Northern Frontier District. One's only got to read Meinertz Hagen's diaries to see the variety of duties that the KAR carried out. And so in that short space of time, we're speaking really of only 40 years, a very valuable regimental spirit had developed And I think it was, as you say, more the King's African Rifles than it was the country, whether it was Kenya that they'd come from, or Tanganyika, or Uganda. It was more the ethos of the regiment.
Did the Tanganyikan troops ever draw comparisons between the British and the Germans?
I heard just a few stories from those askaris whose fathers had served in the German East African forces, and it was quite interesting. I wouldn't say that what I'm going to tell you is wholly reliable. It's only hearsay, after all, nothing documented. But they did say that there was a brutality on the part of the Germans towards their askaris, which the British never demonstrated at all. A brutality in terms of physical punishment, harshness of the German military regime, a pitilessness. And yet, the fact of the matter is that in its own way, the German army in East Africa was very successful against the British, as history demonstrated. And I suppose the askaris who joined the German army there were receiving the equivalent of 2 shillings a day, given that it was 20 years earlier. And so to that extent, were they mercenaries, or were they fighting for a remote figure called Kaiser Wilhelm?
You say the harshness of the German army discipline, yet you've just said the British were using lashing. So how much more pitiless were the Germans?
I think the formal punishment by lashes was very, very rare in the British Army or the East African forces. Very, very rare. One had the impression, talking to those askaris I've just mentioned, serving with the Germans, that it was much more frequent, and therefore a comparison could be made between the attitudes of the military of the two countries.
Now, can we pick up the narrative, and can you tell me how the move to the Far East came?
Yes. So far as I personally am concerned, I learned that a brigade, not my own brigade, was to be sent to the Far East. And I immediately made every effort to join them by a transfer from the 3rd, 6th, happy as I was with the battalion, to one of the battalions within the brigade that was said to be going to the Far East. I had initially not been all that happy when I first joined the 3rd, 6th, that I was going to see as much action as I wanted. And as we were part of Middle East Command, it seemed to me that the quickest route to action following the Abyssinian campaign would be to get into a British formation in the Middle East. And I made every effort then to join the parachute units which were being formed in the Middle East, and made a number of applications. My hopes and aspirations generally were dashed because my aptitude for Swahili had enabled me to pass the mandatory examination, and therefore I was turned down for any transfer on the grounds that my knowledge of Swahili made me more valuable where I was. I reconciled myself to that, and then I thought, well, as the Japs were in the war, and I heard about this brigade going, I must get into it. I then succeeded in transferring to the 11th KAR, which was a recently formed Kenya battalion. Very recently formed. This was stationed at Yatta, outside Nairobi. I was very unhappy in that battalion. I didn't care for it at all. I'm sure that my brother officers were in every way admirable, but I think that I was placed under impossible pressures. If I can illustrate, I was put in command as a second lieutenant of D Company. I was the only officer in D Company of the 11th KAR at the time I joined. I had a British company sergeant major and a British company quartermaster sergeant. I had 240 or so askaris, all of whom were recruits. They didn't know how to put on their uniforms, they didn't know how to put on their packs, their equipment, and they had to be trained in every single respect at great speed. D Company was the only company which had only one officer. It is true to say that I worked my tail off. For those weeks, I scarcely slept at night, because if you had to get your troops on parade for training from reveille onwards, and you had to actually help them into their equipment and inspect them ceaselessly, three platoons in that company at the time, you can see the burden was quite atrocious. I sensed myself becoming isolated from the rest of the battalion. We were out on exercises the whole time, and then a major was appointed to join the company a week or so after the brigadier's inspection. Now, to me, that brigadier's inspection was the turning point, a turning point of that part of my military career. It was to be a formal inspection of the battalion with what is known as the G1098, the full equipment inventory, all laid out for inspection. The troops had to be immaculate, their equipment, their arms, the inventory, their quarters, everything had to be absolutely 100%. Well, I didn't go to bed the previous night. I stayed up the whole night. And when the battalion was drawn up and the brigadier arrived, I was immensely proud of D Company of the 11th KAR. The brigadier and the commanding officer praised the turnout of my company. And then the Brigadier Stockwell, who later became Lieutenant General Stockwell, in praising my company, turned to me and said, "But you haven't shaved." It was absolutely true. I hadn't been to bed. I hadn't been to my quarters. I had just been seeing that the troops were okay. I was absolutely livid with rage at what I saw to be an injustice. Stockwell, of course, couldn't possibly have known the circumstances, but the commanding officer most certainly knew. So as soon as the brigadier had departed, I asked for an interview with the commanding officer, Colonel Church. Well, it must be remembered, I was a very junior officer. It also happened that I was a year younger than my official age. I think I demonstrated my sense of responsibility in all the appropriate ways, but I certainly could not tolerate the circumstances of being in the 11th KAR. And I told the commanding officer that I wished to be transferred immediately to any other unit in the East African forces. I could not remain in the 11th KAR another moment. I went so far as to say, and this enraged him beyond belief, that rather than stay in his battalion, I'd welcome a transfer to the East African Military Labour Service, which are the chaps who dug tracks and roads and things like that. Well, you can imagine, I was thrown out of his office, neck and crop, and told that I would remain in the battalion forever. I resumed my duties, and I didn't slack, but I let it be known that I was there under duress. The adjutant, a few weeks later, sent for me and said that I had been posted as Brigade Orderly Officer of Headquarters 25 East Africa Brigade, which was the formation of which the 11th KAR was a member. I was out of the battalion like a cork from a champagne bottle to take up my new duties as orderly officer to Brigadier Bettington. Those were the circumstances of my departure from the 11th KAR.
What happened next?
The brigade moved down to Moshi in Tanganyika. And of course, one of the duties of the brigade orderly officer, who's the most junior staff officer on the brigade staff, was platoon commander of the brigade defence platoon. So I was back in training in a way with the platoon. There were a number of other duties of a social kind, and also, of course, planning with the brigade major the implementation of the brigadier's movements, inspecting the training that was going on, and so on. So I was with the brigadier all over the place. The officer's mess was a very interesting building. It was in the foothills, at the foot of the foothills, you might say, of Kilimanjaro. And it was a verandaed building, wooden, on stilts. And the most interesting thing about it was it was a pre-war regimental post. And at one end of the veranda was a Vickers gun, which had been used in action against the Mad Mullah. Now, that really intrigued me enormously. It swung on its tripod, and one pretended to fire at the top of Kilimanjaro when one was having sundowners. So my duties were not as military as I would have liked, but on the other hand, I was at least in a brigade which was training for the Far East. I didn't exactly enjoy the necessary, some of the necessary social functions. The brigadier's wife was with him. She made certain demands on of a social nature. She I felt rather tended to believe that she commanded the brigade. It didn't really appeal to me to see this attitude expressed in the way that it was, and I did rather chafe, and I was very glad when we were then posted to Ceylon and took our leave of those circumstances.
What kind of special training had to be gone through in preparation for Burma?
It was the implementation of the manual of battle drill by section, platoon, company and battalion, training in all weapons. There seemed to be a tremendous amount of marching, route marching, seemed to go on forever. But, of course, we were not in the jungle. The jungle training would follow in Ceylon, which was to be, and was, the base for all the jungle training prior to going into Burma.
How did the African troops react to the news that they were going to serve abroad? Did they have any objection to it?
Not at all, as far as I'm aware. It was just accepted that we were going to fight the Jampans, as they called them. I think there was a bit of apprehension on the part of many of us. I don't mean the Africans, but on the part of many of us, the Europeans, because at that time, the Japanese were represented as being a form of supermen, hardened troops. After all, they'd taken Singapore, they'd taken Malaya, they'd swept through the other countries, they'd seized most of Southeast Asia. And there was rather grotesque pictures put up in every barrack room and company office and so forth, illustrating the Japanese soldier, the enemy we were going to fight. I found him rather horrifying and intimidating because he'd been made in these drawings to look utterly fearsome.
What was he doing in the drawings?
Well, he was just standing there, full frontal, with his equipment on, and a description, a printed description of his fighting qualities and his jungle knowledge, which of course we had got very little, if any, jungle knowledge at that time. Because it's wrong to imagine that Africans were trained in the East African jungles, because they weren't. So we were starting de novo, you might say, in real jungle warfare.
How did you prepare the African troops mentally for facing this superman?
I don't know. I don't think we tried.